One evening in April of 2015, I was sitting in a bar in Cambridge, Massachusetts with some colleagues after a workshop at the nearby university. The bar was a classic American bar in the most archetypical American university town. We ate fried food and drank large beers, quickly, straining to hear each other over the rock music playing in the background, surrounded by a crowd of other customers, mostly overconfident young men, increasingly drunk and speaking increasingly loudly. It sounded something like this. Over this din, we were discussing our current projects, and I was telling them about my research on the computation of the voice. Particularly, I was interested in new software that was being designed which claimed to recognize emotions in the human voice. I had, and still have, a lot of trepidations about affective computing tools, but am somehow darkly fascinated with what their design, and very existence, reveals about how their markets conceive of the human, raising questions like, how do they imagine we are built as emotional beings? How do they, quote, listen for this? What effect might this imagination, when implemented in our society, have on our communications? These questions are at the intersection of sound, computation, and psychology, and perhaps can get us into a rather thorny area when we start to ask about the ethics and politics of creation. While an artwork might be unique to an individual artist's experience, and is not generally used on the public so much as it is appreciated or not by it, these algorithms I was studying are designed to be used to perceive and even arouse the feelings of entire populations. That evening, my colleague asked me a much more obvious question about these technologies, one we would never ask about art, which is, do they work? I wasn't sure how to answer her, so instead I suggested that we try one. I took out my phone and opened an app called Moody's. This app no longer exists, and I will later discuss why that is. It was designed by an Israeli company called Beyond Verbal, which is now named Vocalis Health. The app was free to download. Based on a 20-second sample of your speech, it would provide an evaluation of what it called your primary and secondary mood. And so, we tried it. She spoke into the mic of my phone with her soft, twangy, Midwestern accent, which to me always sounds like it has a smile in it and feels, even when she is challenging someone, to be gentle. She spoke about nothing of consequence, describing the day, the scene, what we were doing at the bar. After 20 seconds, it beeped and delivered to us her reading, which it asked us to verify as correct or to choose other descriptors. Anger, a loud and emotional state. Radical leadership, fanaticism, dichotomy. We were both a bit shocked by this, and after a moment of questioning how dichotomy could be considered a mood, she laughed, perhaps a bit nervously, and said it was not correct at all. We tried again with my voice this time. I was tired and withdrawn that day, not feeling particularly confident with these new colleagues, and also feeling weak as I was recovering from a migraine. I spoke to it again, telling it about the bar, our day, our location. My reading was a bit embarrassing. Dominance, preaching. Forceful leadership, dominance. Aggressive communication, anger and contempt. I made a face of puzzlement and denial, performatively disavowing myself of such characteristics. That is the opposite of true, I argued. Another friend across the table who knew me a bit more intimately wryly raised an eyebrow. He knew better, perhaps. As I think back on it, what was most disturbing in that moment was our reaction to the tool's reactions. We both claimed machine error, but we also doubted ourselves a bit and wondered whether it was revealing something deeper and hidden that we are trying to repress through our own manners and language. This, perhaps, is the true power of these tools. They claim to know us better than we know ourselves, and in their deployment, they can take from us both the authority and the responsibility of understanding each other. This question of machine error, whether it works or not, is particularly curious when we ask about affective computing tools, because their entire premise is that they articulate something to us about ourselves which is, in fact, inarticulable by definition. Something which is before or beyond language and therefore very hard to label or predict. Affect is often defined in contemporary critical theory, as well as in the affective sciences, as a feeling or reaction produced by the body before conscious or deliberate articulation can be formed. It is an involuntary reaction, and one that can be empathetically sensed and expressed by other bodies around. The most classic example of this so-called affective contagion is when a crying baby causes other babies to cry, and perhaps adults around to immediately feel either tenderness, anxiety, or annoyance, depending, I suppose, on the adult. When you have a gut reaction to something, become overwhelmed with anger so much that you see red, or burst into tears without first understanding why, we might think of these as affective responses. They happen before we can speak and without our control, and even in describing them here, I have had to resort to metaphors. So a technology, which is of course human-made, that claims to sense and then name the affective, is already performing a task that humans cannot perform. In that sense, we can never really know if it works or is an error, because we have no truth against which to check it. Yet these tools see the voice as the ultimate site of truth, or at least that is what they are selling. One of the earliest patents for vocal affect analysis software was awarded to Nemisisco, an Israeli tech company that develops, quote, advanced and non-invasive investigation and security tools and fraud prevention solutions. What this means is that they are in the business of lie detection and interrogation. They are looking for ways to extract truth from a body without touching that body. The voice has been imagined by these patents and in previous lie detection technologies as a perfect subject for such analysis, a disembodied index of someone's inner workings. In early lie detection tools, as well as in these newer technologies, warblings or waverings in the voice are interpreted as indicative of lies. They are the result of the motion of involuntary muscles, which are suspected to tremble at a higher frequency when a subject is anxious or nervous, and which cannot be consciously controlled. Thus, the pitch and timbre of the voice becomes an indicator not of affect, but of truth, and of the speaker's intentions. While this might make some sense in the abstract, in reality it fails over and over. Both early lie detectors and Nemisisco's new software have repeatedly been proven to be inaccurate and inadmissible in court. When lie detectors work in an interrogation scenario, research has shown, it is not because the machine is without error, but rather because the subject believes the machine will reveal a lie and gives up on lying. The power in the tool is in our belief in it. Regardless of these findings, Nemisisco and other similar companies have continued to develop such technology and have expanded on it, no longer marketing it for lie detection exactly, but rather for the detection of emotional stress. Further developments in this software focus instead on analyzing the vocal signal for indications of different states such as joy, anger, sadness, depression, excitement, etc. In these cases, the algorithms have been trained originally on datasets from television, radio, and from vocal samples of actors performing emotions as they speak. More recently, apps, games, and toys, like the Moody's app mentioned at the beginning, have been used to gather more neutral data from a general population. In both sets, those performed by actors and those gleaned from the wild, the speaker is conscious of the emotion that they are expressing and is involved in coding it, either by deliberately performing that emotion in their voice or by labeling it after the fact. This means that we're not dealing with affect at all, but rather with a consciousness of the expression, which might be called language. Given this understanding, we can look back to the noisy bar and understand the machine error of that evening a bit differently. Most likely, the app was hearing the loud music and excited, aggressive voices in the background and registered those as much as anything else. It cannot distinguish between foreground and background and cannot pick out any individual's voice above another's. What it registered, however, was not some secret aspect of my personality, although those surely exist. Nor was it some affective reaction occurring before I had consciousness of it, but quite the opposite. It detects inflections in sound that are culturally coded to express certain moods or postures. Loud voices with increasing volumes, fast-paced and regular articulations are heard as aggressive and dominant. As any composer could tell you, this is very much in the realm of language, but it is a musical language rather than a spoken one, and one in which we learn to communicate within a given culture. While this might describe some habits in Western music and Western speaking, it would not work at all on tonal languages, wherein the semantic meaning of a word is sometimes determined by inflections in vocal pitch. This is one form of machine error. As these datasets are built and coded by users, the apps lose their purpose for their companies and disappear. Moody's is no longer available, although the company is still active. What is being made now is not commercially available to the everyday user, although it may indeed be used on us every time we reach a call center or a screen for a job. Software is built and sold to recruitment firms, call centers, security firms, police, and militaries. Vocal signal data is aligned with corresponding emotional states, using inflections in the voice as indicators of mood, as well as personality traits that are used to determine whether the speaker is a good investment, confident, stable, creditworthy, or will make a good employee, docile, obedient, reliable. Healthcare benefits administrators use this software to screen claimants for both wellness and sincerity. Some healthcare providers use the software in call centers for diagnostic purposes, particularly to detect depression. Furthermore, newer research is also directed towards refining the affective capacities of virtual humans and virtual assistants, such as Alexa, Echo, and Siri, to better recognize affect and to respond accordingly. Wherein a response includes not only sensitive emotional speech by the AI, but also targeted marketing recommendations via Echo's link with Amazon, for example. This move towards emotional AI, the new buzzword for this is superintelligent hearing, is built on the findings of earlier research. What was once used for detection is now used for simulation of emotions in artificial voices or to transform recorded human voices. For example, in early 2017, IRCAM, the French National Institute for Research in Acoustics and Music, released some openly available software called DAVID. DAVID stands for, and forgive me, I did not name it, Da Amazing Voice Inflection Device. It is a fairly simple but somewhat nuanced tool that allows the user to change the acoustic valences of a sound. Pitch, inflections, vibration rates, and color can all be manually changed, or a number of presets are available which correspond to emotions, happy, sad, afraid, tensed, with versions for male and female voices. We can hear it here, for example. This is my voice with the happy tense setting. This is my voice with the sad setting. This is my voice with the happy setting. This is my voice with the afraid setting. As you may hear, the changes are slight but audible, or perhaps we don't really think that we hear them, but we vaguely feel them. We can begin to imagine how such tools can be used with human as well as AI voices. And this leads to another set of questions about machine error. Most critiques of AI focus on bias, problems like those I've mentioned with the training data being skewed to recognize certain populations and cultures and to misunderstand or never register others, or problems with the interpretation of this data which simply, quote, predict the continuation of existing hierarchies in our cultures which are problematic and oppressive. For example, racist recidivism prediction algorithms, which correlate certain neighborhoods with the likelihood to commit crimes based on past patterns. These errors are surely important to articulate. But when we think about this affective listening software, we need to think about the ways in which its deployment can change the ethical potential of listening on a deeper, intersubjective level. There is something uncanny and startling about tools like DAVID, which in some way, by some definition, in some context, do indeed work. There comes a moment when we are confronted with the feeling of realizing that we can, to some extent, trick ourselves with the technologies and short-circuit the work of human listening and expression by generalizing these processes. Really, what these technologies do is save us from the pesky, confusing, and time-consuming task of understanding and getting to know each other, a type of listening that is fraught with mistakes and struggle, but also can carry with it possibilities for bonding and care, but which is so specific that it would never make sense to market it writ large. These tools save time by generalizing our voices and create a sort of objective distance. No longer is listening a relation between speaker and listener, but rather one between speaker and end user. The ethical question then becomes about which kinds of relations we want to create and for what purposes.